On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is when we slow down developments, take them one at a time. A couple items up for discussion. A legal complaint argues that the state elections agency should remove more than 200,000 voters from the state's voter rolls. We'll look at that complaint from Will, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And the state Supreme Court is taking up a case brought by Will challenging the governor's veto powers. Should there be a limit to the governor's veto pen? And then on the voter rolls, have you recently moved but not updated your voter registration? Have you responded to a mailing on your current address? We're at 800-642-1234. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, and she co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast, and she joins us most Mondays. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at these two legal challenges coming from Will, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. The veto power situation, what is the challenge there? What does this lawsuit do?
So this lawsuit is challenging several of the governor's budget vetoes from the state budget bill. Essentially, what they're arguing is that his vetoes went too far, that they didn't just alter the language passed by the legislature. They actually created new laws. So they're calling it, they gave it kind of a snazzy name in the lawsuit. They're calling it the magician's veto. We sometimes, you know, kind of waved a magic veto pen and transformed the language into a new law. We kind of have these ways of describing gubernatorial vetoes in Wisconsin. We've had the Vanna White veto in the past, where you take out letters from words. The Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So this is kind of, I think they're kind of trying to add to that canon, if you will, and just say that this is a power that the governor has. And they acknowledge it's a power that the governor has had for obviously a while, and an act that previous governors have done. In this lawsuit and in their conversations about it, they have said that Governor Evers isn't unique in issuing this kind of veto. But they said they haven't really had the resources as an organization to challenge this until now. And so they say, you know, this has been part of the history of Wisconsin, but we think the line needs to be drawn right now.
What happens if this lawsuit is successful? What would the situation be?
So this would obviously make it impossible if the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, agrees with Will's argument for future governors to change bills to the extent that, you know, the argument can be made that they're transforming the language into something that wasn't legislative intent. But it would also knock down several of the governor's budget vetoes that are specifically mentioned in this lawsuit. So I think a big one that we've talked about somewhat frequently is this $75 million grant program for local road projects. The governor's veto didn't change the amount of funding for this transportation initiative. Essentially, what it did was it changed how the money was dispersed. It changed it from something that was already allocated and identified to different groups to this grant program that was administered by the Department of Transportation, kind of creating a pot of money and giving the department more discretion. That's something that really concerned Republicans because of just distribution of funds throughout the state. So there are some specific things like that that would be struck down. But I think the more kind of broad-ranging impact of this is just the future powers of the veto pen of the governor in Wisconsin.
He also had vetoed four abortion-related bills.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So this wouldn't necessarily have to do with that because this is a partial veto issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when the governor entirely vetoes a bill, which is what he did with the abortion bills, you would see the only way that the legislature could interact with that would be with to override that veto with a two-thirds vote.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a more legal avenue for individuals, the legislature, outside parties to argue that a governor's partial veto, where he just changes it rather than knocking the whole thing down, was inappropriate.
We're doing a roundup on politics with WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White. You can join in. Should there be a limit to Governor Evers' veto powers? What are your thoughts here? Are you a city clerk? What are the biggest challenges you face with running elections. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Somewhat of a parallel here, let's look at the constitutional amendment that is up for debate. Republicans recently held a hearing to prohibit Governor Evers from using his veto pen to increase spending. And this has been in the works since July. What is being discussed around this amendment?
So this is another response to some of the governor's partial budget vetoes. Republican lawmakers were concerned about one of the governor's vetoes that increased school spending by about $65 million. He kind of nipped and tucked from a variety of other programs in the budget to create that funding. Lawmakers were concerned that he made that kind of financial change that they didn't agree with. So they introduced this proposed constitutional amendment, which is a way that you can limit the governor's veto powers, to make it so it would be impossible for the governor to make any change that increases state spending. So we talked a little bit about, you know, the Vanna White veto, the Frankenstein veto. That is how this process that they're proposing for this provision, that's how those things went into place. You propose them in the legislature, they have to pass two consecutive legislative sessions, and then they have to go to a statewide voter referendum. So if this successfully passes the legislature this session, we'll be seeing it back again next session, and then again before voters.
But Wisconsin gives its governor some of the most sweeping executive powers in the country by way of you can strike out words, you can merge sentences here. I mean, is this type of amendment just a long time coming here that, you know?
Well, I think, there definitely has been a movement in recent years to kind of put some checks on the governor's veto power. So we have seen these couple constitutional amendments over the past 30 years or so. I think, the conversation is just about how much power is the legislature and then, of course, the people of Wisconsin comfortable with the governor having. The governor does have some of the strongest veto powers in the country. You know, he can strike words, he can change punctuation. So there are a lot of things that the governor can do and could still do, honestly, even if this constitutional amendment were to go into place as well.
Well, to go into place, there are still quite a bit of barriers to that. How close are Republicans from putting this amendment into action?
Well, there are a lot of steps. You know, it would have to, this is very early in the process. This was just a public hearing. So it would have to pass the Senate and the Assembly this session, do the same thing next session, and then go to that statewide voter referendum and pass as well. And we've seen a statewide voter referendum fail recently, the referendum that would have eliminated the state treasurer's office. So we know that, that's obviously not a guarantee. It passes the legislature twice and makes it to that step. It's not a home run at that point.
Well, let's look at sexual assault here for a moment. State lawmakers met recently to consider this proposal to adopt a new Bill of Rights for sexual assault victims. What would this bill mean for Wisconsin?
So this is part of a nationwide push by an advocacy organization and some individuals involved with sexual assault policy across the country. Essentially, it would give sexual assault victims rights above and beyond those that are already afforded to crime victims in Wisconsin. So, for example, they would be guaranteed the right to choose whether or not to cooperate with law enforcement. They would be able to have the right to bathe immediately after their forensic examination. They'd have the right to have their evidence stored from that examination for 50 years, whether or not they choose to have that tested.
We are in the mix of the State Capitol Report with WPR's Laurel White as our guide, and you can join in. What should lawmakers do to address election security? Is an election security council enough to guard against hackers? Have you recently moved but not updated your voter registration? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. There's more State Cap in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're taking developments one at a time. A new council met last week to look at cybersecurity ahead of the 2020 election. Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She says the decentralized election system is a mixed bag.
Having 1,922 local election officials involved in the process can be a little daunting. I think it also has an opportunity for us to have 1,922 points of strength in our system.
So what should lawmakers do to address election security? Is an election security council enough? Do you think Wisconsin should be more timely with purging voters if you've moved from your address? Join in 800-642-1234. And Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. She stays with us. Laura, we saw the new Wisconsin Election Security Council come together last week, 18 different organizations, including the FBI. They all meet together. What do we know what went down? What was discussed?
So this was the first meeting of this new council that was formed. So it was a lot of kind of laying the groundwork, figuring out what these different organizations do, what kind of roles they play in ensuring election security. I thought some of the really interesting things they talked about in terms of initiatives that are already in place are things that they're doing to help small towns in Wisconsin, more rural communities, clerks that don't have a lot of resources, to kind of learn about election security, get up to date, get the systems that they need to be secure ahead of the next election. Some of those things include online training on how to deal with cyber attacks, things like phishing emails. They're also rolling out a grant program for local elections officials that need to update their software ahead of the 2020 presidential election.
Oh, just like, you know, basic software upgrades to Windows 10.
Yeah, exactly. This is something that I wasn't aware of until I started talking a little bit more about election security. But, you know, the switch from Windows 7 to Windows 10, Windows 7 is no longer going to be supported by Microsoft in January. And that can lead to some, you might not think about it, it's not necessarily an elections issue, but security patches and things that will no longer be provided are crucial for the security of those local clerks' computers. So getting that funding to them and educating them about that switch, things like that are kind of a big focus of this security council right now.
Why do you see election security a major focus for Wisconsin officials right now?
So this has been a really big conversation since 2017. You know, we found out in 2017 that the previous year, Wisconsin election systems or state computer systems, rather, were targeted ahead of the 2016 presidential election by Russian hackers. We know that they kind of the language that they use within the security community for the state is they were knocking at the door. They mm-hmm. didn't get in. They did not successfully hack any state systems, but they attempted to do so. So this is something that people in Wisconsin take incredibly seriously in terms of making sure that the strength is there to continue keeping those folks out.
Well, let's take a look at the Elections Commission. You spoke with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, who filed a complaint against the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Here is Deputy Counsel Lucas Weber.
Our primary concern and the main reason with filing this complaint is to get the Wisconsin Elections Commission to do what the law says.
Okay, so what is being argued in this complaint?
So this is a legal complaint against the Wisconsin Elections Commission, one of the members, obviously, of that security council, that they're not following a state law that has to do with maintaining voter rolls in Wisconsin. So basically what this process is that they send letters to individuals that have been flagged for the Elections Commission as potential movers, somebody that's changed addresses. They get that information from a national system called ERIC. Wisconsin is a member of this system. ERIC flags people who have submitted change of address forms to the U.S. Postal Service, a different address on their vehicle registration. So the Elections Commission sends a postcard to that individual at the address where they have them registered to vote. And they say, hi, we have reason to believe that you may have moved. Do you still live here? If you still live here, let us know. We won't change anything. But if that person doesn't respond to that postcard within a certain amount of time, the Elections Commission removes them from the voter rolls at that address. It's just kind of a process of cleaning up voter rolls, making sure they're not bloated with people with the incorrect addresses. Where this legal complaint comes into place is the amount of time that the Elections Commission is waiting to remove those individuals. So the Elections Commission is currently under a policy waiting up to 2 years for someone to respond respond to that postcard before they take them off of the voter rolls. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty in this legal complaint is saying, hey, there's a state law that says you need to remove these people if they don't respond within 30 days. So we think this is a big problem, and we think you need to be changing your policy.
Well, let's take a call on this now. Mike joining us from Ladysmith. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, this is an issue that when I first heard it being brought up a couple weeks ago, just totally got my goat, because we just went through a whole big push to get forced into using voter IDs. Now, I don't have a problem with using voter IDs. That's not my gripe here. But one of the reasons for doing a voter ID is that you either use a driver's license or a DMV-issued ID, both of which have the address of the holder on them, and under what materials you need to register at the poll, one of the allowable items to have, in fact, the preferred ones, are your voter ID, the same thing you use for voter ID. So to me, this has become a bookkeeping exercise. This should not be an issue that's being pushed as hard as it is, you know, as if it's some kind of voter fraud. We have Register at the Polls, which has been a Wisconsin institution for decades, and we have voter ID, which has our legal address on it.
So, Mike, as you're saying here, that the processes are already in place. Laurel?
I think that's a really important point, that we do have same-day registration in Wisconsin. So individuals that aren't registered to vote can go in and do that. I think another important nuance of this complaint is that we're talking about people moving, right? And in sort of having their previous address in voter registration and having a new address in voter registration, how those things might complicate the system, compromise the integrity of voter rolls. And it's important to know, I think, for people who might not be familiar with the ins and outs of voter registration in Wisconsin, when you register to vote at a new address in the state, your previous registration is obviously wiped out. Mm. So it's not as if someone who has moved and doesn't respond to this postcard in 2 years but registers to vote in their new address is going to have two voter registrations in place and can go in and vote two times with two different IDs, you know, if they hang on to their old address or anything. So I think noting that is important. As Mike also mentioned, an individual with their new address can go in and register on the same day, too.
Well, let's talk about some things that people might go to vote on here as we talk with WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White in a roundup. Let's look at the 7th Congressional District. Last week, we saw the first Democrats announce a campaign to fill the seat vacated by former Congressman Sean Duffy. Brings the total number of candidates to 5. Who are these candidates?
So these two candidates are Lawrence Dale and Tricia Zunker, I believe. I haven't said her last name. Mm-hmm. Tricia Zunker, she's a Wausau school board president. She would be, interestingly, the first Native American representative in Congress from Wisconsin if she's elected. Lawrence Dale is a businessman, a veteran. Interestingly, he held his announcement in the state capitol, noting that he currently lives in Michigan, but he's planning to move to Wisconsin and into the district soon. So these are two individuals that, you know, as you mentioned, are coming in on the Democratic side of the race. We've had a pretty high-profile Republican candidate in the race for a while. State Senator Tom Tiffany has kind of been making the rounds for a couple weeks, getting to know voters. So now we're getting a little bit more of a partisan balance in terms of who's in the race and who's out there talking to people.
Shifting over to the 5th Congressional District, where we saw the retirement of Jim Sensenbrenner, what do we know about the candidates running in this district?
So this is the kind of a stronghold of Republican Party politics in Wisconsin. We've had a whole lot of folks express interest in running for this race. As of right now, we have one Republican candidate, Republican State Senate Majority Leader, actually, Scott Fitzgerald. So we're keeping an eye on that candidacy, and a number of other people who are considering a bid for that race, including a colleague of Senator Fitzgerald, State Senator Chris Kapinga.
All right. So we'll keep an eye on that. And quickly, before we let you go here, Governor Evers signed an executive order last week to create a climate change task force. What do we know there?
So this is a large group of people that the governor has gathered. It's individuals from government and from industry, agriculture, higher education, that are all tasked with helping the state mitigate and respond to the effects of climate change. This is something that the governor has talked about a lot. He talked about climate change during the campaign, bringing a phrase he uses, bringing science back to the state of Wisconsin. So this is something that's very much in line with a conversation that the governor's been having for a while.
Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter, and she co-hosts the Politics Podcast. By the way, the Politics Podcast will be in Waukesha Thursday doing a live episode at Ray's Grain Brewing Company at 7:30. Coming up on the State Capitol Report, it's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. What questions do you have for the speaker? What do you want to know about lawmakers' work so far this session? What do you think lawmakers should be focused on? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Speaker Voss after this news update here on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Assembly Speaker Robin Voss on the line. We'll move through a range of topics, including breaking down the rule changes in his chamber. One change gives lawmakers the ability to repeatedly vote to override the governor's vetoes of a proposal. Should there be a limit to Governor Evers' veto pen? What questions do you have for Speaker Voss? We're at 800-642-1234. Robin Voss has represented the 63rd Assembly District since 2005, which includes a large swath of Racine County, encompassing the communities of Burlington, Rochester, Sturtevant, and Union Grove. He's been Assembly Speaker since 2013. Representative Voss, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. You formed several task forces this year to tackle issues of water quality, adoption, suicide prevention. And so now those groups are producing recommended legislation. They have ideas. What are some issues in the state you hope to resolve with this type of work?
Yeah, so early on in the year, we knew, of course, because we have split government now, that we wanted to find things that hopefully wouldn't be partisan, that we could find easier agreement on than some of the arguments that people would like to have us take up. So we made these three task forces. I think they're focusing on really important issues. They've involved both Republicans and Democrats, and they have literally gone around the state. One is still not concluded yet. So as you mentioned, we have the first one, which is on adoption. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin, we have less than 1,000 adoptions a year, and we certainly have way more than that for children who need to have a loving home. So we want to make it easier to adopt. We want to try to have a goal of doubling that number within 5 years. We want to make sure that kids who are in foster care can find a way to get to a loving family quicker. Our process is one of the most cumbersome in the country as far as wanting to be able to adopt a foster child. So I think we're trying to find ways to really make adoption easier, and I'm glad to say it's bipartisan in almost every circumstance. The second task force was focused on suicide prevention. Wisconsin has a problem like many places around the country where far too many people think that their only option is to ultimately take their own life. So this is another example where we're coming up with some very good ideas. They'll be voted on in November in a way to try to help reduce our suicide problem in Wisconsin.
Well, I want to pause right there on suicide, because there is a lot of focus here in Wisconsin and across the country for that matter on youth suicide. But adults and elderly suicide is more common. Where do you see a need for more attention or resources on this issue?
Well, number one is to make sure, especially for young people, I think when I was younger, I'm about 50. So when I was younger, we did not have the same level of bullying. We did not have the same level of social media where people were actually to bully in a way that will never even be known by another person. So I think that's an area, especially for kids, that we have to focus on. And I hope we can do some more on that. But for older folks, those who are no longer in school, the idea that the only way out of your either financial situation, a bad relationship, is to take your own life, is to make sure we have the resources for people to talk to someone. So one of the proposals from the task force is to actually increase the ability for people in different fields, different professions, but also in just different places in the state to have a call-in line, to have more interaction. So if you are, you know, hurting or want to talk to somebody, there are resources that are available in every part of Wisconsin.
And then finally, water quality is the other focus on your task forces. How can lawmakers address water quality issues?
The task force is not yet done. They're still concluding their report. They're going to report sometime later this year with action, hopefully in January and February. You know, it really comes down in my mind to finding ways to be innovative. It's not just sprinkling a bunch of money to a bunch of existing programs. It's trying to look at the problem holistically and totally differently. So my hope is that we're going to be able to fund research, that we're going to be able to be innovative. We're going to be able to find technologies that will help to solve the problem. Because for most of Wisconsin, access to clean water is not a problem. But for much of Wisconsin, it sure is. We see that if you have a municipal water system, for the most part, with a few exceptions, you already have access to good, clean drinking water. But for those of us who are on wells or in rural areas, we've got to make sure that the contaminants that potentially could be in the ground from runoff or all the rest of the potential environmental issues are dealt with. And I think the task force will have some good creative ways to do that.
We're talking with Republican State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, looking at initiatives in the state legislature. Let's move to tax cuts. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald recently told WISN Radio that he supports more tax cuts.
I would love to lay some type of tax cut on the governor's desk before this legislature adjourns. I've talked to the speaker about this. You know, he's a thumbs up on it as well.
Speaker Voss, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau recently found Republicans saved taxpayers $13 billion from tax cuts since 2011. Do you support more tax cuts?
I always support the idea of having more money stay in the pockets of the families around Wisconsin. We're still among the highest tax states in the entire country, especially when you look at the property tax, which is such a big burden to Wisconsinites. So, yes, we know that last week, the Fiscal Bureau certified under the information provided by the governor that Wisconsin actually has more money in its checking account due to our fiscal management and the ability for our economy to keep growing. And rather than just spending that on a bunch of expansions of government, of course, my priority would always be to try to find a way to return that back to the taxpayers in a prudent manner. We haven't agreed on any idea yet. We certainly would want to sit down and talk about it with the other elected officials. But it's a good goal, and it's one that if we have the ability to get it done, I would certainly support.
Our state's tax burden has dropped to its lowest level in almost a half century. Can the state afford additional cuts?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, don't forget, last time Governor Evers and Republicans agreed on almost $500 million in tax cuts that were focused primarily on lower income people, but it really helps every single person who pays taxes in the state. So we were able to do that while still making a historic investment in medical spending and health care and also in education. So there's no doubt we can do it. But at the same time, our priority has to always be making sure that we have a tax burden that can keep people in their homes, that can allow folks to be able to stay in Wisconsin when they retire, and to hopefully grow and raise a family right here in Wisconsin instead of having to move to be able to afford the burden of taxes.
Well, let's take a call now. Mary joining us from Brookfield. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning. I have a question for Mr. Viss. Is it Viss?
Speaker Voss. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Oh, my question is, what did he mean by split government? I'm not sure what he means. We have one government in the state of Wisconsin.
Split government.
He called it split.
Yes, because of a Democrat in the governor's.
Right. I understand I'm asking him.
Okay.
What does he mean?
All right. Speaker Voss, go ahead.
Thanks for your call, Mary. Yeah, I mean, of course, Kate is right. We do have split control because we have, of course, Governor Evers in control of the executive branch and the legislature strongly Republican. So that's the reason that when Democrats propose so many divisive issues that they know are not going to be able to have a bipartisan consensus, I feel in many ways it's just wasting our time. I would rather have us focus on things that we know can actually be accomplished. That's why if you look at the topics that I chose for our bipartisan task forces, they were things that don't necessarily have a partisan breakdown where we're just going to have more frustration and argument. I want to actually get things done for the state, and that's why I think these task forces are a great way to do it. Unfortunately, it seems like Governor Evers usually chooses much more hyper-partisan topics to bring up, but that's his decision, and we have to just figure out how to work best together.
Let's go to Dan now in Milwaukee. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
My question is, what is Speaker Voss planning to do to investigate the Public Finance Authority and figure out who's been using it to stockpile junk bonds, which could put Wisconsin at risk long term? Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Speaker Voss, what about the Public Finance Authority?
Well, the good thing in Wisconsin is that this has absolutely no bearing on the state of Wisconsin and having anything that we would be ultimately financially responsible for. What it is it allows private investors to go in and buy risky bonds. It's not something that I would ever do, but I certainly think if an investor wants to go in and get a high rate of return on a project that can't get traditional financing from a bank or anything else like that, they have the right to do that. The good thing for Wisconsin is that there is nothing that we are on the hook for. It is literally the bondholders who have to do it. So I'm always open to looking at it, but I just want to correct the record because that's actually not accurate.
And the long-term bond market, though, and other signs from Wall Street have concerns up about a potential recession. If lawmakers, say, would approve a tax cut now, is the state ready to weather an economic downturn?
Well, the best news that we have going forward is that under Governor Walker and Republicans, and it's been continued under Governor Evers, we have actually over $600 million in our rainy day fund. When Republicans took over from the last Democratic governor, we had, I think, $1 million or $2 million in our rainy day fund. So we have seen a dramatic increase to make sure that if we have an economic downturn, that we are going to be able to weather it. I strongly support keeping that fund whole, not using it until we really do have an economic problem, because what happens is every time we have a revenue reestimate to show our increasing economy, half of that money automatically has to go into the rainy day fund. And that's why it's been growing over time, because Wisconsin's economy has been so strong under Republican leadership.
Well, let's shift to marijuana now. Jeremy in Racine, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My concern is right now Wisconsin is surrounded by three states, Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois, two of them which I believe is going to recreational cannabis use. And Wisconsin's still way behind the times on this issue. And I'm wondering, when is Wisconsin ever going to get fully medical marijuana legal? I know we are CBD legal, but we are nowhere near the rest of the states. And we have issues with people going across state lines.
And Jeremy, we're short on time here. Speaker Voss, you support allowing a form of medical marijuana. Is that right?
I do. I actually believe that if there's a way for us to put a proposal together, again, hopefully on a bipartisan basis, that would allow us to have a limited form of medical marijuana, I certainly would support that. I do not support recreational marijuana, and that's my fear. I do not want it to be like in other states where a limited form of medical marijuana eventually becomes recreational because of the huge financial incentive that some people have to legalize recreational. So I think we should be able to do it. I know that right now there probably is not the support that's required, but part of my job is to work with folks, see how we can bring people together and see if there's the potential in the next few years for us to be able to get that done.
It is a conversation with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. You can join in. How do you think Republicans can work with a Democratic governor? Where should the parties dig in, and where do you see room for compromise? What issues matter to you? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Representative Voss for more discussion here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we have Assembly Speaker Robin Voss here on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Where should lawmakers increase their efforts? Is your top issue education or economic development, health care, transportation funding? Share your story, your questions, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Speaker Voss, the UW system is considering mandatory suspension or expulsion for students who disrupt free speech on campus. You support legislation that would require the system to adopt free speech policies. Do you support the Board of Regents' proposed rules here?
I do. I think that the idea of having free speech on campus is one of the most fundamental things that happens during a student's experience when they go to the university. And the idea that someone can go to a speaker and shout them down, thus preventing students from hearing, from challenging, from questioning, is really what concerns me. And it seems like that is becoming far too common as a way for us in society to deal with someone we disagree with. I think the best thing that we could possibly do is to have the most free speech we can possibly imagine so that everybody has the opportunity to have their viewpoints heard and no one's ever shouted down. That should never be an acceptable form. You can be outside the room. You can be, you know, handing out leaflets. You can, you know, have a picket. You can do all kinds of things. But the idea of shouting people down should never be acceptable anywhere, much less on a college campus.
There have been some groups, including the Charles Koch Institute, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, who've come out against mandatory discipline. Here is Will Creeley from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, known as FIRE.
The intent is to send a message. Unfortunately, that message will likely result in students rationally deciding to stay home rather than go out and exercise their First Amendment rights on campus. Seems to me that's a net loss for everybody.
So the groups argue UW's proposed free speech policies would be unconstitutional or produce a chilling effect. What's your take there?
Well, it's a prime example where even groups that I fundamentally disagree with ideologically can be wrong. The idea that we want to allow individuals to go in and disrupt a speaker should never be a proper forum for us to have debate. So I hope that we'll be able to, you know, look at potential changes if there are constitutional concerns. But I really think the idea of just having a fundamental acceptance that everyone should have the right to speak and no one should ever be shouted down, that should be a bipartisan issue that 100% of Americans agree with. And I hope we'll be able to find a way to make sure that it meets constitutional muster and can also protect students and the ability of speakers to come to campus.
Let's go to Dan now, joining us from Madison. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I was wondering if Representative Voss would be able to comment on the state compensation plan. As I understand, he's the co-chair of the Joint Committee on Employment Relations, and just wondering if he can provide an update.
Dan, thanks. Representative Voss, a status update on the state employee compensation plan.
Sure. Thanks for the question, Dan. Under the law, the governor has to forward the plans that have been put together by his administration. Now, under Governor Walker, that usually happened in a pretty timely basis right after the budget was approved. I sent a letter to Governor Evers about 2 weeks ago asking him why he had not yet forwarded the comp plan for us to be able to act on it. He hasn't done that yet. So my hope is that he will, you know, as expeditiously as possible, send that to us so we can take it up. Employees deserve the raise that we gave them in the budget. You know, we were able under Governor Walker to give raises for each of the past few years, and we were able again under Governor Evers to continue that going forward. But you're right. It makes no sense to try to have some kind of a delay, especially knowing that it's already been adopted and people want to be able to depend on that raise coming forward when they get their checks in January.
Well, looking at the assembly just approved the new rules for overriding the governor's vetoes, which of the governor's vetoes do you support taking up through the override vetoes this fall?
We have to go through the discussion with our caucus, but I think the governor made a series of bad decisions through his vetoes that I want to have us take a look at. Simple things regarding the ability, you know, who should be qualifying for welfare? Should they be able to, you know, have multiple attempts for us to look at it? And that's part of the deal that we want to go through. We want to have a thorough discussion. We want to talk about it with the public because we believe that when the public understands the impact of Governor Evers' vetoes, that we'll be able to significantly go toward getting an override, and if not, hopefully build it up over time.
In terms of the four abortion-related vetoes the governor made back in June, is that something you're looking at?
It is something we're going to look at. We know that because Democrats are so lockstep with you know, abortion providers, where they get a significant amount of their funding from, they are probably unlikely to switch positions. So we're certainly going to look at it. But the idea of saying that someone who delivers a child alive and then allows that child to die should not be prosecuted really strikes at the heart of why I think so many Americans are becoming more and more pro-life. Because if you can't say that killing a child who's already been delivered alive should be illegal, I think it really goes to the morality of our country, and hopefully we will be able to at least talk about that and perhaps convince enough of my Democrats to take a different position, but I'm not optimistic.
We're talking with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss here on the State Capitol Report. Let's go to Michael now, joining us from Appleton. Hi, Michael.
Hi. So with Speaker Voss's remarks on free speech on campus and that sort of thing, I was just wondering, so to what extent does that belief sort of extend for you? If someone is planning to come on campus and the tagline for their speech or for their evening is Juden raus, and their subtitle is Hitler did nothing wrong, do you still believe that that's not an appropriate time to go shout down a speaker or a guest, or, you know, is there a line there?
All right, Michael, thanks for the call. Speaker Voss, where is the line on free speech? Is it arbitrary, or can we have some clear consensus on it?
Well, first of all, under the university's own rules, they have to have a sponsoring student group. So that would be the first step. The second step is, if you remember, one of the most important free speech cases was when the American Nazi Party wanted to march through Skokie, Illinois. Now, I think that was a despicable act, and one that I certainly would have been there on the sidelines saying they shouldn't have the ability to march. But ultimately, the Supreme Court decided that they should have the right under the free speech motto to march in an area, even doing something that's despicable. So I think we really have to be careful when the government begins to say that any speech is something that we don't even have the right to be heard. Because, you know, I think it was Justice Brandeis who said that the best disinfectant is the ability to have sunshine on an argument. And I think that's where we look at that, to say I would never want them to come to campus. But if they came, I think it's important that the next people who were there would have the ability to refute everything that they said and why their beliefs are repugnant to Americans. But I think the idea of simply saying that when they come to campus, we're just going to shout them down or try to stand in front of them, it just reinforces the idea that some people wrongfully have, that they, you know, are somehow being persecuted. And that's not the idea. We want their ideas to be, you know, excoriated, not the individuals who want to express them.
Well, your colleague, Representative Jimmy Anderson, came on our program last week on the State Capitol Report. He criticized Republican lawmakers for allowing day-long voting periods despite his physical disability. What do you think about limiting floor votes to 6 hours per day?
Well, let's remember where we were and what's happened since I became the speaker. Prior to my tenure, we would regularly have debates that were 12 to 14, 24 hours long. Our longest debate, led by the Democrats, was 63 hours during Act 10. So the idea that somehow that, you know, things are as bad as they used to be is pure, you know, untruth. When I became speaker, we started to limit our sessions. We have very rarely, during my 8-year tenure, had a session that went overnight. We want to try to be able to have our debate during a single floor day. And that's why, you know, for the most part, it's the Democrats who have been leading the charge to have longer debates over the past 8 years. That's why we wanted to make those changes. And I think ultimately the idea of having reasonable floor periods are what's going to happen. It's what's happened under my tenure as speaker, and I think it'll continue going forward.
Speaker Voss, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Kate. Have a good day.
You too. Robin Voss is Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, and he represents parts of Racine County, including the communities of Burlington, Rochester, Sturtevant, and Union Grove. Just ahead, we catch up with Wisconsin's aviation industry and then discuss a range of gun policy issues, including a new case before the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.